now begin looking at the relationship between God and humans. Because after we have looked at God, which is the, in my mind, the main point of the revelation of the Old Testament, after we have looked at what the Old Testament says about God, then the next point, in a sense, is to look at the human-divine relationship, what the Old Testament tells us about God's relationship with us and our relationship with God. And the place that we really need to start is probably with the image of God. And so that's the first topic in the category of relationship with God, or human-divine relationship. The image of God is actually first introduced to us in the first chapter of Genesis, when God says, "Let us make man in our image and after our likeness." And so then you have the creation of Adam. And remember, if you look at the stages of creation, you have, first of all, the natural creation, if you want, geographical creation, the water and the land and all of these things. Then you have the creation of the birds and the fish and then the animals and so on. And then you have man. And man is the one that is said to have the image of God. And so it's important to realize that right there at the very beginning, in Genesis 1, it teaches that man is unique to all other creation. And because man is unique to all other creation, what this also says to us is that when you look at all that has been created by God, the relationship between the human and God is a fundamental difference to that between all the rest of creation and God. And you may remember from the New Testament, Paul says, all creation waits anxiously for the revealing of the sons of God because it had been subjected to the curse of sin and death and evil and all of these things, topics that we'll take up later. It had been subjected to all of these things after the event in the Garden of Eden that we call the fall. And with the revealing of the sons of God, then all nature will be restored back to its original situation at the time of creation. And so, essentially, what this is saying is that the human-divine relationship is the system or the structure that guides everything else that is going on in all of creation. So, there are some different things to look at in terms of this image of God that man was created in. First of all, one of the Hebrew words is tselem. And if you look at a copy of the notes, you'll see the Hebrew words in there. One of the Hebrew words is salem. And this word is essentially the image. Salem refers to two or three dimensional representations of something, whether it's of God or something else. So a painting is a two-dimensional representation of something. I took a picture a little bit ago of the view outside the front of the seminary because it snowed, and quite frankly, we don't see much snow in Atlanta. And so it's still something kind of interesting to all of us there. And in other places that I've taught, including in China, they don't see a lot of snow either. And so it's always a little bit interesting to see pictures of the world with snow on it. To you, you see it all the time. So I took a picture. The picture is a two-dimensional image. It is an image of what we see out here. It would be like a salem. It can metaphorically, that is in a non-literal way, it can also involve ideas of shadow or dream or reflection or some outward representation, or it can even refer to that which was conveyed from Adam to Seth. So Seth, who was the third son of Adam that we know of, Seth had the image of Adam. Did he look exactly like Adam? Probably not, because he also had a mixture of the image of Eve there. But there was the image of Adam that was conveyed from Adam to Seth. And so he very clearly looked human. He did not look like an animal. He did not look like a bird or a fish. He had the image of a human. Okay, so humans, according to Salem, were created after the pattern of God and are copies of an original form, that of God. And it can also suggests the idea of any child reflecting the physical or soulish aspects of the parents. So many, many times, because I looked very much like my father, many, many times when my father and I would be somewhere together, somebody would comment on the fact that we looked so much alike. And we did. This is the image of the one conveyed to the other. And to a fair extent, this happens in many families where the child looks very much like the parent or one of the parents. This is, again, something of the idea of Salem, a child who acts very much like the parent in thinking, in emotion, in all of these things, is another application of the word Salem, because the child's inner soul is like that of the parent. And so this is the idea of Salim. There is another word in Hebrew that relates to this, and that's demut. And demut, at least in English, generally translates to likeness. The idea is the limitations of the extent to which a visible copy actually copies the original. So, for instance, with the photograph that I took of the snow out here, it shows the scene, but even if it was a three-dimensional image, which it is not, you would not feel the cold. You would not hear the truck that was stopping at the light just before I took the picture. You would not feel the snow coming down and actually touching the skin and things like that. It is a likeness. It is not an exact and total copy of the original. That's the concept of demut. It's a likeness, but it has certain limitations. And so the image of God and the likeness of God immediately imposes a limit on the nature of that image. And so in the use of both of these words, what it's saying essentially is that the image of God is similarity, but not identical. And this is the Old Testament concept of the image of God. Now, one of the problems with the image of God is that there has been a tendency to separate the use of the word image from the Old Testament background. And so you get all kinds of philosophical, rational ideas that have emerged regarding the concept of the image of God and how to think about the image of God and things like that. And in the modern age, it has become very common to get sometimes some very strange things that come out of taking this word, the image of God. So it's important to understand Hebrew is different than Western thought. The Hebrew language and the Hebrew concepts are very different than those of Western thought. In Hebrew, for instance, the concept of image is holistic in character and not analytical like the Greek and Western thought is. And so it does not separate the human existence into categories like body, soul, and spirit. But rather, it is holistic in the sense that you simply have the human. And the human bears the image of God. And so when you separate things into body, soul, and spirit, you immediately are going into a more analytical Greek Western concept, which you, when you find this in the Old Testament, you are to some extent imposing on the Old Testament thought forms and ideas which do not really exist in the Hebrew way of thinking. They would not think of the body as separate from the soul, or the body as separate from the spirit, or the soul as separate from the spirit. And in fact, one of the big controversies in Greek and Western thought is whether humans are body, soul, and spirit, or just body and soul, which we will not attempt to resolve here in this course. The Israelite understanding of creation is, particularly creation of humans, is that the image of God applies or refers to all of humans. And this was somewhat different than the pagan world, which focused its concepts primarily on kings, nobility, priests, in other words, the upper part of society. And everybody else were just simply to be used by their gods and then essentially thrown away. In addition, in the Israelite understanding, the image of God does not distinguish gender or social relationship. And so image of God equally refers to male and female. Image of God equally refers to slaves and masters, or politicians and everybody else, or anything like that. The image of God refers to all of humanity and not just some particular portion of it. What this means is that from the Hebrew standpoint, the Old Testament standpoint, image of God implies a relatively equal status of all persons before God, and that there are none that are more equal and none that are less equal before God. And you do see this sometimes in the Old Testament, where, for instance, in the book of Psalms, a lot of times you find the psalmist talking about, I was bothered by the fact that the wealthy, the politically powerful, the physically strong, they seem to prosper, whereas the rest of us struggle to make it through life. Even though these people do wrong and sinful and sometimes awful things. And I wondered why they should prosper until I thought about what happens after death. And then I realize that there is a reward after death. I'm kind of summarizing what a lot of these kinds of psalms say. But then I realized after death, the lot, the experience of these people is going to be very much worse than the experience of those of us who are not wealthy, who are not strong, who are not politically powerful, but we have maintained our faith and our relationship with God. We have done what is right and so on like that. Well, the idea that lies behind that is everybody is equal. And in the judgment, whether you were high and mighty, rich and powerful, or you were simply lowborn and struggled to make it through life, will not matter in the judgment. Everybody will stand equally in the judgment and receive the appropriate reward for what they did in life. And so then the psalmist is comforted by the fact that they know that for them there will be a reward. For these others, they will receive according to what they did in life, which presumably will not necessarily be as wonderful as what the psalmist did. Well, this is the Israelite understanding, then, of the image of God. It immediately is holistic in character, applying to every aspect of the person's life, and it immediately implies that all are equal before God, and that there are not some who are more equal or some who are less equal, as in this life. There's a couple of other approaches to image that need to be touched on. One is the idea of the body as the image of God. And this is one of the interpretations, and this is one of the common interpretations you find, to the notion image of God. Physically, humans are, as I said before, completely different from all other creatures. Humans stand, they walk upright, they possess bodies that are in some way copies of God's form. And so you have the dramatic example we've referenced before of how Moses was allowed to see God's back as God passed by. In that passage in Isaiah 6, where Isaiah says, "I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and the glory of his train filled the temple," and so forth like that. And it talks about the seraphim. With two wings they covered their eyes, with two wings they flew, and with two wings, it says, they covered God's feet. Actually, that is not what it says in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, it says, with two wings they covered God's genitals. And so the concept there, again, is that humans are a copy in some physical way of God who created them, whereas animals are not. Animals may be greater or lesser degrees of some sort of an image like that, but humans are created physically in the actual image of God. And so the likeness or image of God on this basis means something like or similar to or corresponding to God, and his image is the basis for a relationship with God. Because humans are similar to or like God, there is, in a physical way, then there is this basis for building a relationship with God. That's not something to push too far, but certainly you can take that idea and use it in the human dimension. My sister has a couple of birds. Now, she's not married, and so her companionship, if you want, are those two birds. And when she is at home by herself, she may talk to the birds. The birds actually talk a little bit, but not in the sense of communicative. They just repeat phrases that they've heard and so on. But She does not have a genuine relationship with those birds. She is simply the caretaker of those birds. But if she had a physical human that was in the house, then she could have a relationship with that human. Many people have cats and or dogs. Again, they have kind of a relationship with the cat or dog. But at best, it is a very primitive, unsophisticated relationship, mostly that of a caretaker. And certainly nothing like a relationship with another human being. And the simple fact that one human being and another human being have the same physical image provides the opportunity, provides the opportunity for a relationship to be built, a true relationship, not a caretaker relationship, not a primitive relationship, but a full relationship to be able to be built. This is one interpretation of the idea of the image of God. It's not a complete idea, but it suggests the idea that humans, in the image of God, can also have a relationship with God. Whereas all of the rest of creation does not have the opportunity to have that kind of a relationship with God. There is also a relational interpretation which essentially focuses on the image as being the fact that the humans, being unique to creation, can have a relationship with God, while nothing else in creation can have a relationship with God. Theologically, the image of God, first of all, does suggest that humans can have a special relationship to God, which is different from all other parts of creation. Now, animals and any living thing do have the ability, you might say, to relate in some way to God through the fact that they were created in this world. But they act out of instinct. They do not act out of will. They do not pray. They do not do other things. They simply do what was, in a sense, programmed by God into them to do, as dogs or cats or birds or fish or whatever the creature is. And so humans have the uniqueness of a special relationship with God. Other elements of creation do not have. It's given by God. It was His design. It was His initiative. And this is different theologically from the modern view that sees humans as simply the top of an evolutionary development. Theologically, there is no real place for human evolution from the animal world. Now, where you may or may not be in your personal thinking about evolution is up to you. But theologically, particularly from the Old Testament, man is not the top of an evolutionary development. Man is a uniquely created being, bearing an image of God that no other creature bore. And one of the things that uniquely distinguishes humans from all other creatures is that when God created Adam, if you remember, it says that God breathed into him the breath of life, and man became a living being. And so the Bible is very careful in the early chapters of the book of Genesis to demonstrate that, unlike all of the other creatures who simply were formed and came alive at the word of God, humans were a special creation and came alive at the breath of God, breathed into them, not just simply through the creation as an act of his word. So, from the theological standpoint, humans are unique. And theologically, there is no place for the idea that humans evolved from some lesser life form. Vocationally, humans, being in the image of God, were created to rule over the rest of God's creation. In other words, to be stewards and what could be called vice regents or co-regents, that is, co-rulers with God over creation, to rule in not instead of God, but to rule in a more direct way in the presence of God. And so you see this in the creation story of Adam as well, because after he created Adam, he says that he is to rule over creation and to subdue it. In other words, to bring it under his control. And what you see, even immediately, is God bringing all of the creatures, all of the animals, to Adam, and Adam naming each of these creatures. And in the Old Testament, especially, there is a concept that we may touch on later called naming over, which is the idea that if you have the name of something, you control that something. A few minutes ago, during the break, I was kind of looking through the notes to see where we might go in the next session, and one of the students was sitting here and trying to get my attention. Apparently, not very successfully, until she said, "Mr. Bennett," and I looked up like that. Suddenly, she had control because she called my name. This is the idea of naming over. And Adam, by naming each of the animals, was symbolically asserting his authority over those particular animals. And vocationally then, humans have the authority over the rest of creation. And every time, for instance, a new species of anything is discovered, The first thing that we want to do is give it a name. And even if we don't give it a final name, we give it a temporary name to be able to identify that particular thing, whatever it is, until we decide later on a name. Always in the human realm, we want to name things, which gives us, in essence, a certain sense of authority with regard to those things. Well, it's the image of God that equips us to be stewards and co-rulers or sub-rulers on behalf of God over creation. And in the biblical context, the command is the only explanation or description that follows God's image. God's image is never talked about in abstraction. You find that common in the Western world. You find it common today for people to kind of speculate about what the image of God means and what it is and things like that. But in the Old Testament, the image of God is very specific, and it conveys to humans a particular responsibility to rule over the earth, to rule over creation, and to subdue it. That does not mean to misuse it, but simply to rule over it and subdue it. In other words, learn to control it. There's another aspect to the image of God, which is that humans are God's representatives and mediators between God and His creation. And this is sort of implicit in the idea that humans are to rule over the earth and over the creation, because in so doing, they are mediators between God and the creation that He created. In the polytheistic world, kings would oftentimes set up statues of themselves in the various cities around the kingdom where they ruled. And this physical form was intended, one, to say to the people, "I am your king, you must obey me." And it was also to, in a sense, convey the idea spiritually of the king's presence in that particular location. Idols carried out a similar kind of a function in the polytheistic world, because the idol was, in a sense, the mediator between the god and the people. The idol represented the presence of that god in the midst of that particular group of people. Well, in terms of humans and the image of God, humans are a living mediator, not an idol, not a statue or something like that, but a living mediator, a living presence of God among each other as well as among the rest of creation. And so humans are, in a sense, a reflection of the presence of God wherever they are, even if they are evil and horrible and so on like that. The fact that they have or are in some way associated with the image of God, the person is, in a sense, conveying themselves as a mediator or presence of God. And if you have someone who is kind and gentle and loving and understanding, this is fairly easy to see. If you have someone who is harsh and mean and murderous, this is really a difficult thing to see. And so I don't want to push that idea too hard, except to say that humans are intended to be a living representation to one another of the presence of God and the mediation of God. And you can take this a step further, since we're about to go into a break. Take this a step further. We as Christians are intended to be the living presence of God's redemption to the rest of the world. That's what the image of Christ means biblically. We communicate the living presence and redemption of God to the rest of the world. We have been redeemed, and we demonstrate to the rest of the world that no matter who we are or what we have done, we are not somehow separate from them. And no matter what they have done, they are not somehow unable to find the redemption that is theirs in Jesus Christ. So we bear the image of Christ to the world, and we are therefore mediators of God between humans and God, just as Jesus was when he walked the earth.